Okay, so the rain was too much for most of the class to overcome today. But I appreciate your hunger, you guys. And we will march through some relativity today. You got a lot of points somehow in the back of my head for your attendance. So we were talking about, last time, covariance and trying to set up equations for everything that matters, like Maxwell's equations and the motion of charged particles, in a notation that the way I think about covariance is that if you write an equation in manifestly covariant form, it's sort of brain-dead obvious how it behaves under Lorentz transformations. And so let me give some further discussion of this point. So as an example, if we have a rank 2 contravariant tensor, we will be encountering some soon. Then this transforms under Lorentz transformations. As the quantity in a prime frame can write as this partial derivative with respect to the primed relative to the unprimed contravariant components. But now we need two of these factors because there are two indices to transform. And f sigma delta. So dx prime alpha, dx sigma, dx prime beta, dx delta, and then f sigma delta. And which is also, of course, then lambda alpha sigma, lambda beta delta, f sigma delta, and summed over sigma and delta, the repeated indices. Here I've already violated one of the rules I told you I try to always follow notationally, which is to have the adjacent indices match. So I would really ideally like to recast this with the sigma close to the sigma and the delta close to the delta on the right. And in fact, you can do that by rewriting this as f prime is lambda f lambda transpose, right? So this tilde is meant to indicate the matrix transpose. And this is also discussed in the context of equation 11.147 in our favorite tome. Now, if you have a four-vector, suppose we have covariant components of a four-vector, B beta, right? And then if we have a contraction of F, a contravariant tensor F alpha beta with B beta, then again, the beta index is eliminated from the final quantity. It will only depend on an alpha superscript. So we know that this will be transform, let me call it y alpha. This quantity transforms like a four vector, contravariant four vector. And this is analogous to when we encountered three-dimensional tensors, like the Maxwell stress tensor and ENM1, where we had a tensor dotted into a vector, which became an ordinary vector with respect to three-dimensional rotations. And in general, you can keep going with this as necessary. You can have F prime with many indices, alpha prime, beta prime, gamma prime, delta prime, for instance. And this will be, you can string together a Lorentz transformation factor for each index to relate this to the quantity in the unprimed frame. So you would have alpha prime alpha, beta prime beta, and so on, lambda, gamma prime gamma, lambda, delta prime delta, F alpha beta, gamma delta. Just notational stuff that you might encounter, although you probably won't see quantities higher than second rank, possibly third rank, occasionally. An important quantity to put in covariant form is the differentiation operator. Okay, so there is a four-vector generalization of the three-dimensional gradient operator. Del, right? And one way to kind of motivate this is to let A be some constant vector in three dimensions. And then we know that the gradient of A dot X, gradient with respect to X, right, is the vector A. And I want to consider the four-dimensional generalization of that in the special relativity world. So we could consider a constant four vector A alpha, consider its contravariant components, and we can make an invariant out of this by taking its dot product with its invariant product, I should call it, with the vector, the time position vector x, we've been writing in this notation for four vectors, which is A alpha X alpha contraction. Then D by DX beta, differentiating with respect to the covariant components of X, of this invariant. This will give the contravariant components of the constant vector, A beta, the analogy to this 3D equation. And so we can see that this means that D by D X beta transforms like a contravariant four vector. And of course, we're building up. We're going to be re-expressing Maxwell's equations. And there will be these four vectors floating around, differential operators, when we do that. So we have to get used to working with those. And And so let's be a little more explicit. So d by dx sub alpha, we can sometimes write as an abbreviated notation as partial superscript alpha to indicate, to help us remember that this is a contravariant tensor or vector, even though you're differentiating with respect to covariant, or I should say because you're differentiating with respect to the covariant components. And what is this exactly? It's d by d x naught. X naught is c times time, of course. And then the negative of the usual gradient operator. Analogously, this operator, partial subscript alpha, means the derivative, abbreviation for derivative with respect to the contravariant components. And that would be d by dx naught positive gradient. And that's covariant four vector if it acts on any scalar. And this would be contravariant. I don't know that. Do you know?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, okay. It's like they say it lives in the dual space. Well, but it just means you can take a dot product and map it to a scalar.
Yeah. This just occurred to me now. I was trying to remember if that was the case.
Guess analogous to Bras and Ketz in quantum mechanics. Another important operator you encounter, we've encountered a lot already, is appearing in the wave equation, is the contracted operator of these two contravariant and covariant derivatives. Which we usually write this way. Is a box, or when you want to be fancy, call it the Dell-Embershon. And who doesn't want to be fancy?
It's kind of funny, it's like the beginning part, it sounds a lot like Dell, too.
So that you can write this contraction like so, and it's this operator squared dx naught squared minus del squared, or more explicitly 1 over c squared d squared dt squared minus del squared. So this clearly is a Lorentz scalar or invariant. So I want to next build on this, try to re-express some of our familiar equations that we've come to know and love from E&M in this manifestly covariant form. Again, which has the advantage when you see equations in manifestly covariant form, it's brain dead obvious how they transform in different reference frames under Lorentz transformations. So, first one is I want to look at the inhomogeneous wave equation for the potentials. And I'm going to, of course, look at these now in Gaussian units, whereas we encountered them before in SI units. Which were given back in Chapter 6. They look simply like Dell-Embershon acting on either phi or A. be minus del squared minus 1 over c squared dt squared acting on phi or a. Can set this equal to, of course, with phi, you remember that this wave equation for phi has on the right-hand side 4 pi over c times c rho, where I've just inserted a 1 over c and the c times rho to give it the same units as the current density in the equation for a. So that's the collection of four wave equations for these four components of phi and a. And this has, in addition, the Lorentz gauge condition, which says 1 over c d phi dt plus del dot a is 0. So that's one of the equations we're going to recast in a minute. Second equation is the charge continuity equation. Which in SI units, 1 over C d phi dt. Sorry. Confused myself. It's d rho dt plus del dot j equals 0. And so this equation suggests that we could define a four current because we see the derivatives that are part of the four vector differentiation operator that we could define a four current as its contravariant components will be, the time component will be c times rho, and the space component will be the ordinary current density, current charge per unit time, per unit area. And now we can see that the charge continuity equation becomes the contraction of d alpha with j alpha, right, d by dx naught of c rho plus del dot j is 0. Which is would also be the same as d superscript alpha j subscript alpha. Okay. So if we have this current density 4 vector, charge current 4 vector here, then it also is what appears in the inhomogeneous wave equations. Which basically suggests that this equation, this first inhomogeneous wave equation I wrote down, means that the D'Alembertian operator acting on this phi A should be a four vector, since that is a scalar acting on this quantity gave this 4 pi over c times c rho j. Right. So that means we can write or identify a superscript alpha as this, the contravariant components of a potential 4 vector composed of the scalar potential and the ordinary vector potential. And finally, the Lorentz gauge condition in this notation also can be put in manifestly covariant form. D alpha contraction with A alpha is zero. So now we have the potential equations of motion. The governing equations for the potentials has been placed in manifestly covariant form. And some of the implications of this, we think now about making Lorentz transformations of these quantities, is that under a Lorentz transformation, right, we'll have A alpha components get mixed up into different components in the boosted frame. And so that implies there's going to be a mixing of the scalar and the vector components once you go into the boosted frame. And similarly, you'll see a mixing of rho and j. They get mixed up. What was a current charge density in one frame becomes a current density in a moving frame. Well, it's not too surprising, because we said before, if you had a chunk of charge, right, rho, moving at velocity v, that corresponds to a current density j equal to rho v. And so you could have, in the rest frame of this charge, you would have no current density. But if you boost, look at it from a moving frame, then it is a current density. A few kind of formal things about Lorentz transformations that I don't want to go into in great depth, but I kind of want you to have heard about them. So I'm just going to state a few things without proof at this point. And next time, if you ever are doing work in QED and such, and you encounter some of these ideas in formal mathematics or physics, it'll ring a bell. Okay, so this is coming to some of the material in section 11.7 of Jackson. So the most general, what I will call proper Lorentz transformation, can be written as follows. As an exponential operator, E to a matrix L, okay, which L is a 4x4 matrix, and for the simplest case, if you have only a boost, that's what we've talked about in our Lorentz transformation so far. Let's consider a boost by the boost parameter zeta along the x-axis, which we'll call the x1 axis. We know that lambda is this matrix, cosh zeta minus sinh zeta minus sinh zeta cosh zeta, and 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, and 1, 0, 1, 0, 1. Okay. On the other hand, you can have part of the whole class of general Lorentz transformations includes the rotations as well, the three-dimensional vector part, the rotations. So in particular, for rotation about the z-axis, that matrix would be 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, and it will mix the x and y components with cosine of a rotation angle omega, sine omega minus sine omega cos omega 0, 0, 1, 0, 0. And you can do this for, boosts along any axis and rotations around any axis. So we can put all this in a very general form, which is useful to know. And we can identify the generators of infinitesimal boosts and rotations. So let's consider a boost by a vector beta now, which could have three components in general in an arbitrary coordinate system. And that can be written in this notation as lambda is e to the minus zeta vector, three-dimensional vector, dotted into a vector of matrices, and this zeta vector means a beta unit vector in the direction of the velocity times the arc hyperbolic tangent of the magnitude of beta. And the three matrices, k1, k2, k3, are they're given in the text, equation 1191. K1 is this very simple matrix, 0, 1, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, and the rest zeros. Similarly, K2 is 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, and the rest zeros. And K3 is 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, and the rest zeros. And these are the three generators of infinitesimal boosts in the respective coordinates. On the other hand, a pure rotation has the infinitesimal rotation generators. S1 is 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, and 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, minus 1, 1, 0. For a rotation about the x-axis, mixes the y and z components. Similarly, S2, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0. Minus 1, 0, 0. And finally, S3, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, minus 1, 1, 0. Okay, so now I think it's kind of elegant that you can now give the, in terms of these generators, right, each of these accomplishes an infinitesimal action, either a boost or rotation, and if you now make an infinite product of infinitesimally small transformations, that becomes an exponential operator, like you learn probably in your graduate quantum courses, that the general, most general form of this generalized Lorentz transformations will have an e to the minus omega vector dotted into what I'll call the spin vector minus zeta vector dotted into the k vector. And these six matrices, they form a group which is called the, is there a question?
Oh, no, I was just thinking, because this is like a generator for the Lorentz group.
That's what I'm just saying now, yeah.
Yeah, and I was trying to remember that, like, there's the convention that usually there's an I in the exponent, but then sometimes it's not there, and I was trying to remember if it really was just like, sometimes the I is there, sometimes it's not, or if there's a convention for it.
Yeah, it'll be clear when I write the commutators in a second.
Okay.
I think. So these six matrices obey commutation relations, and those commutation relations define the Lorentz group, which I will write now SI SJ epsilon IJK times SK. So this should be reminiscent of your angular momentum operators, except as you mentioned, there's no I floating here, just as there's no I here. So you can take those I's out, basically. We have the boost infinitesimal matrices. I have their commutation relation as well, that their commutator is minus epsilon ijk sk. And finally, the mixed rotation commutator with boost SI with K sub J is epsilon IJK K sub K. Which you can see, for instance, one important consequence is that boosts along different axes don't commute, just as rotations don't. About different axes, don't commute. Okay, so where are we? Okay, I think we're ready to start talking about the Thomas precession effect, which is a kind of tricky subject. It's actually addressed in two different sections of chapter 11, treated at two different levels of sophistication. And I'm really not going to follow either of them, but I suggest you read them, those two sections of chapter 11, about spins in rotating frames in chapter 11. But I'm going to try to give a more pedestrian treatment that gets across the physical idea. So That's this next topic, Thomas precession effect. I think the physicist's name was Lowell Thomas. He did this work in 1927 to resolve a mystery about the spectroscopy of atoms when you tried to understand spin orbit interaction in atoms like hydrogen or alkali atoms, because the simplest explanation failed. Okay, so let's talk about spin orbit interaction in hydrogen. We all learned about as undergraduates. Right, so if you, the kind of simplest picture of a hydrogen atom, you find there's a 2s and a 2p energy level. When you look into it a little more carefully, you find the 2p level is actually split into a 2p 1/2 and a 2p 3/2, and this is what's called the spin orbit splitting between the two components, the two J values of that p electron. And that's what we call the spin orbit interaction. And you can view this qualitatively, at least, as the interaction between the electron spin magnetic moment the electron in the atom has this its own intrinsic magnetic moment, and that is interacting with the magnetic field caused by the proton moving through space, the fact that it's a charge moving through space, which is a current loop. From the electron's point of view. Right, so like if you think of the Bohr atom, right, we usually think of that for a hydrogen atom as an electron moving in a circle around the proton. So from the proton's point of view, the electron looks like a current loop. But if we look at this from the electron point of view, the proton is going around it, which is a more useful point of view because the proton magnetic moment is three orders of magnitude smaller than the electron magnetic moment. And this could cause hyperfine physics, several orders of magnitude smaller than the electron magnetic moment interacting with the proton current loop.
So for different atoms, I guess, would it just be a proton? Would it just be kind of like an effective charge that you would assume is going about the atom with the electron?
It's a little more complicated. You'll see how we'll generalize the formula beyond a Coulomb potential, if you have a screen potential due to the other electrons. Right, so the proton from the electron's point of view is moving at some velocity around the electron. And if we just consider the Bohr picture and look at the circular orbits, then we can calculate the magnetic field by the time average current at the position of the electron and then just take minus mu dot b. That's basically how I first saw this derivation as an undergraduate. So let me sketch that derivation briefly. basically what is the magnetic moment of the electron spin, degree of freedom, right? In Gaussian units, that's minus the G factor of the electron, which is approximately 2 times the magnitude of the electron charge over twice the electron mass times the speed of light, and the spin operator. That's not the S operator I wrote over there. It's the normal quantum mechanical spin operator. And so next we will need the magnetic field that the electron sees due to the proton viewed as a time-averaged current. And then this elementary form gives a term in the Hamiltonian for the spin orbit, this picture, which we would expect should be minus the magnetic moment of the electron spin dotted into that time average B field from the proton current. So let me quickly remind you how we use Biot-Savart law to get that magnetic field that goes in that formula. Right. In Gaussian units, B is I over the speed of light, integral dl cross x over the magnitude of x cubed. In SI units, you probably remember this formula, you had a mu naught I over 4 pi, and that becomes in Gaussian units just I over C. So here, all these, the vectors are at right angles from the current loop elements, right, V and R for a circular orbit. So this is elementary. We can write this as I over C times the integral over dl will give 2 pi R, and we'll have a 1 over R squared from x over x cubed, and that will be because the current is, of course, the charge magnitude of the proton divided by the period, which is EV over 2 pi r in the Bohr orbit. And so putting these factors together, we have EV over 2 pi C, and then 2 pi R for R cubed, which I will rewrite as E over the mass of the electron times C times R cubed times MEVR, but this is just the angular momentum, magnitude of the angular momentum vector. So putting all these together, this minus mu dot b works out to be plus the g factor of the electron, again, approximately 2 times the magnitude of the electron or proton charge for 2 m mass of the electron squared, c squared. And then instead of 1 over r cubed, which you would have for the potential of the, if you have the hydrogen atom potential, this we will write in the more general form as 1 over r d u dr, where u is the potential energy minus ce squared over r for a hydrogen atom. But in a screen potential, you can put in the screened potential here, and I guess this EGA is part of the U, so it's just that. But there is for it, but I haven't put in yet the angular momentum operators, the spin, and the orbital angular momentum. Okay, so that's the elementary derivation of the term in the Hamiltonian through this argument. So that's one way to derive it. Jackson gives a second way to do the elementary derivation, and I should first of all point out this gives the wrong answer. It's presented in most undergraduate classes, though, even though it's the wrong answer, because it's only, turns out, it's only wrong approximately 2 times too large. So what's a factor of a half among friends? Very tempting, just stick in a 1/2 and proceed with your life. But that wasn't good enough for Lowell Thomas. He figured out where that comes from. But let me actually first do an alternative derivation of the wrong result. Which is more or less in Jackson. So what we can do instead of the previous argument, we can just make a Lorentz transformation of the electric and magnetic fields. We haven't actually derived that yet, but I'll use one of the results from when we are about to derive it in the next couple of lectures. Transform from the nucleus rest frame into the instantaneous rest frame of the electron. So claim is that the magnetic field seen in the electron frame, instantaneous rest frame. Now, all this, of course, should make you a little nervous because the electron's not really, its rest frame is not an inertial reference frame, which is the crux of the issue. This would be when we learn about transforming fields. This turns out to be gamma times B minus V over C crossed into the E field seen in the proton frame. And now in the proton frame, of course, there is no magnetic field due to the proton's motion because the proton has no motion in the proton frame. So this is zero. But the proton is experiencing an electric field. And so, right, just the Coulomb electric field. And so the argument in Jackson goes as follows: to look at the classical equation for spin precession of the electron spin in this magnetic frame. So in the magnetic field in the electron frame. So the classical equation for spin precession we learn in quantum mechanics. Right, a magnetic field exerts a torque on a magnetic dipole, which gives a time dependence of the angular momentum associated with that angular momentum, that spin angular momentum, which is the cross product of the magnetic field experienced in the frame of the electron. That's the physics of this precession, of this spin, if you place it in a magnetic field. And so we will plug in this formula for the magnetic field experienced by the electron. Get ds dt is minus mu s cross v over c cross e, and e of course is minus the gradient of phi. R vector over R magnitude d phi dr, which is 1 over E R vector over R magnitude du dr. And so if you have a precessing spin, you can write the energy of interaction of that precession. That's a formula we all learn, right? Which is minus mu dot b. And I'll call that w prime minus mu dot b of the electron frame. Minus mu s dotted into minus ve over c crossed into that e field, and putting this in, plugging in for e, we get this term from the elementary derivation that would go in our Hamiltonian for the electrons in the atom would be ge over 2m squared c squared s dot l, and this is the electron mass, by the way, and 1 over r d u dr. Same result as the other derivation gave, and equally wrong. So how can we try to fix that? That requires thinking about the physics in rotating frames. I remember the first time I was in an undergraduate serious classical mechanics class, and I learned about Coriolis force, you know, things happening because of the Earth being in a rotating frame as it rotates about its axis. This kind of blew my mind and made me think physics was hard. I wasn't used to thinking in three dimensions at that point. But that's what I guess we all have come to grips with in the course of our undergraduate education and got past it. But it's still kind of tricky stuff. Okay, so we need to recall something that we learned when you learned about the Coriolis force. You might review your Goldstein or your favorite classical mechanics text. let's look at the rate of change of a vector and this would really apply to any vector in a rotating frame. So let's take ds dt, for instance. Its value in a non-rotating, or like inertial frame, its value should equal the value in a rotating frame, rotating at frequency omega. I guess I'm going to even call it omega t for Thomas. Crossed into that vector. Does that equation remind you, look familiar from your classical mechanics days? You buy it? You're happy with that? How did that come into your last paper? Oh, okay, yeah.
So if you do it formally to derive the operators,
You make use of that all the time. Okay. Okay, so omega t is the angular velocity of rotation that was derived by Thomas. In his 1927 paper, and so basically what we should do is correct the precession formula I wrote before, ds dt in the non-rotating frame, which had this mu cross b seen in the electron frame. But now we'll have this extra term, s cross omega t. And so that changes the precession frequency, energy of precession from this minus mu dot b I wrote before to a new term, which will be our old term. Well, let me write it this way. W prime plus S dot omega t. We have an extra piece that was not included before. So next we need a simple derivation, and here I'll deviate from Jackson, of this frequency. And instead of thinking of an electron, I'm going to think of a space shuttle going in a circle around a proton. I guess it's got to orbit something. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to approximate a circular orbit of a space shuttle. Space shuttle electron. by a polygon with n sides. And n, of course, will be large. We'll take ultimately the n going to infinity limit. And we're going to consider our shuttle traversing just one of the straight segments of this polygon. So, okay, what I want is imagine one section of the polygon is here with our space shuttle. Like that, and then it's going to have to go here, and it will, you know, stay aligned with its orbit all the time. Forgive my art. And at each bend, it's going to have to change by some angle, theta, like here, between the segment, one segment to the next, it changes by theta. And you can think of this as breaking it down into components. Delta x along the previous axis and delta y. And so theta will be approximately delta y over delta x. And in the large n limit, this will be a very small angle, much less than 1. Okay. So because there are n segments of this polygon, right? The angle has to change for one segment this angle should change by theta is 2 pi over the number of segments in radians. So then after n segments, the shuttle will come back. It'll be back at its original orientation and its original position. Okay. But let's think about this in the shuttle rest frame. I'm still not out of time, right? Yeah, okay. In the shuttle rest frame, claim the rotation angle is larger because of relativity. And the reason is that theta prime will be gamma times theta because we should use the fact that the parallel component is Lorentz contracted. So it should be delta y over delta x over gamma, in fact. Because the x component is Lorentz contracted, but the y component is not. And that means after one complete revolution and the shuttle is back to where it started, the same point in one revolution, the electron or our shuttle has experienced a little extra revolution, extra contribution to the number of radians it has rotated through. Namely, 2 pi g- gamma instead of 2 pi. So, in particular, relativity causes the rotation to be different. An extra amount in the rotating frame and I'll write the amount. Caused by relativity, this extra amount is 2 pi times gamma minus 1, which in the lab frame which is approximately the frame of the proton is sitting there since it's so much heavier than the electron. This means this is a frequency ratio of omega t over omega, which is minus delta theta over the period divided by 2 pi over the period, which is minus gamma minus 1. So in other words, this omega t claiming should actually be minus gamma minus 1 v over r, which is, if you take the small gamma or small velocity limit of gamma minus 1 to order 1 over c squared or v squared over c squared, that's minus a half v squared over c squared times v over r plus order of v fourth over c to the fourth. And the velocity v over c is about 1 over 137 in the ground state of the hydrogen atom. So it's a very small number, v over c. So it's quite good approximation to just take it to this order. So, pushing this through, we have, of course, this equation from the Bohr model, mv squared over r is the electric force. For the case of a pure Coulomb field, or for more general field, we have to take the derivative of the potential, like for a screen potential, and use that electric field. And this gives omega t is minus a half 1 over mc squared, mass of the electron, c squared, vr over r du dr. And we can do again an m over m and convert this mvr to an angular momentum and write this omega t vector now as minus 1 over 2 m squared c squared l orbital angular momentum operator times 1 over r du dr. So we're now ready with the space shuttle electron model to put the final Hamiltonian together. So the energy in the lab frame, the only inertial frame in this problem, is W, which is W prime plus, again, S dot omega T. Right, this has an energy, right? Because S has units of H bar. And that is G over 2, 1 over M squared C squared S dot L, 1 over R du dr, minus, now the correction, 1 half, 1 over M squared C squared S dot L, 1 over R du dr, which we can combine into the correct spin orbit interaction term in our Hamiltonian. Is W, which now reads G minus 1 over 2, 1 over M squared C squared S dot L, 1 over R du dr. And of course, G for the electron is, to a very good approximation, 2 a part in, I forget, 1,000 or 10,000, something like that. And so G minus, this G minus 1 over 2 factor is 1/2 instead of the old value G over 2, which was 1. And that modified term gives agreement with experiment. Yeah?
Did we only take like the difference here because the rest we had already taken into account?
Yeah, that's the idea. Just this extra relativistic bit, which would vanish if gamma was exactly 1, if you had V equals 0. So I should point out that in Schrodinger theory, you have to basically add this term by hand to the Schrodinger equation of the electron motion in an atom. But in the Dirac relativistic quantum physics, relativistic wave equation, this spin orbit physics is automatically included in the wave equation. And you don't have to do this tricky Thomas derivation. Except there's one small, very small problem. Namely, in the Dirac equation, G of the electron is exactly 2. And we know quantum electrodynamics modifies that with corrections you get from renormalization, and you'll learn about that in quantum 3 if any of you are going to take that course.
Why is it taken to be exactly 2 in the Dirac equation?
It doesn't know about renormalization and the virtual photons in the universe and all that stuff, all those Feynman diagrams that are partly are making up the electron mass and all that stuff. Do you have a better way to explain why G is 2 in the Dirac equation?
They don't tell you that in quantum theory.
Okay, that is the Thomas procession. And there's a fancier discussion, like I say, in two different sections of chapter 11, Jackson. Something to read in your vast spare time. And we will go through the field transformation in covariant notation next time. And by the way, I won't be here the rest of this week after today. So if you have questions about homework or anything, you can send me an email. And that's enough for today, I guess.